Hello and welcome to the Logistics Tribe. I'm your host, Boris Felgendreher, and my guest today is Eric Johnson. Eric is Senior Editor of Technology at JOC, the Journal of Commerce. He's a highly respected journalist who has been covering the fields of logistics and supply chain for most of his career. He also understands the space of LogTech especially well, and that's why I asked him to come onto the show today to share with us the logistics technologies and startups that he's particularly interested in or excited about. This turned into a wide-ranging conversation about LogTech and startups, past, present, and future. I really enjoyed this conversation, and I hope you will too. Let's go. Eric, welcome to the Logistics Tribe podcast. Thanks for being on the program, man.
Oh, I appreciate it, Boris. Thanks for inviting me.
Eric, we were just chatting before this call, and we're trying to recollect when our path first crossed a few years ago when you were still at American Shipper, right? And I was at GT Nexus. We probably crossed path a few times. So you've been in the business for quite a long time. You're now the senior editor for technology at JOC, right? The Journal of Commerce, that venerable old publication. And I just Googled it and I realized it's founded in 1827, so it's almost 200 years old. That's ridiculous. You're older than the New York Times. I had no idea.
it's like the exact opposite of a startup business at this point. So interesting bit of trivia around the JOC is it was founded by Samuel Morse, who obviously invented the Morse code as well.
So, oh, wow.
It's actually pretty incredible to be at a organization that has so much history and is so intertwined with kind of global trade and commerce around the world for so long, but is still kind of kept itself relevant throughout the years.
Yeah, that's no easy feat, right? I mean, a lot of trade publications have gone under, media is under attack and in commotion and in change for a number of years now. So American Shipper, the publication you spent a number of years at, that has also been acquired, right? After you left, I believe.
I left in early 2018 after about almost 13 years there. They were acquired the following year, I think about a year and a half after I left, by FreightWaves.
Yeah, lots of consolidation happening.
Yeah, there is. Yeah.
So you're a journalist by trade. You've done nothing else but journalism in your life, right? In your professional career, let's say. How did you how did the passion for journalism develop? And was there a passion for logistics, or did you just sort of stumble into it?
No, very, like I think a lot of people stumbled into it purely by accident. So I guess I realized, well, I originally wanted to be a professional basketball player when I was a kid, and stopped growing at a certain age, and realized that was going to be, I was pretty pragmatic early on. So I realized that was, you know, the chances were slim to none. Yeah. And so I thought, well, what can I do to get to be close to that game? And I said, well, I could be a reporter. I'm pretty good at writing. Uh-huh. I could be, you know, and I could be attached to the game that way. And so I took a liking to writing and reporting fairly early. I got into it in high school a little bit. I wasn't like editor of the student newspaper or anything, but it came naturally. And then, you know, kind of chose a university to go to that was very strong in journalism, thinking that would be my path. And I liked it. It actually gave me a chance to really study a wide range of topics, because when you're a journalism major, like you don't need to learn physics and math and all these things and layer your knowledge in one, you know, tight vertical. You're actually encouraged to go learn about politics and space and science and,
become,
you know, social studies
and, of sorts. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. Renaissance person you're supposed to be, right? So that was, I really enjoyed that. And just got a job covering really boring city sort of administrative stuff in a very small town in Southern California near where I grew up. And that was my grounding. And then, went to the UK cause I always wanted to study abroad and wanted to get a bit of business background, because I was finding the stories I was most interested in were business related, but I had no grounding in business. So got a master's degree. And when I came back, the opening at a newspaper in Southern California, the only opening on the business desk was covering the ports of LA and Long Beach.
Nobody
so
else wanted to do that.
Just by chance. Well, the person who had that role left for I think he left for a job with the Port of Long Beach. Uh-huh. And so there was an opening at this time that I was looking for a job, and I said, sure, that sounds interesting, not knowing, you know, that one like little thing would define the next 20 years of my life. Yeah. So that, I mean, that was literally, that was 2003. So, going on two decades. So yeah, been, got an opportunity to join American Shipper a couple years later, just based on a recommendation that the port actually made. Mm-hmm. They were looking for someone on the West Coast to cover, container shipping, and the rest is kind of history.
And then you slowly evolved and moved into the technology space, and I consider you one of the recognized voices in the space of LogTech. I mean, that's something that you've made yourself a name for. I come across a lot of people who think very highly of you, so that's why you're on the program today, because I want to talk to you about LogTech and all of the stuff that's happening there, especially in the startup sphere. And I asked you to come prepared with a couple of or handful of interesting, intriguing startups that you know of globally, that people may have heard of, or maybe some examples that people haven't heard of that are just interesting and intriguing and that you think are worth mentioning. And let's go through those. And, you know, that's sure. That's also an area of my interest. I've worked with a lot of startups in my life, and for LogTech in particular. So that's sort of also up my alley. So it should be a great conversation, hopefully.
Delighted to talk. I mean, I live to my wife and kids' chagrin. I think about this stuff far too much. So I'm more than happy to to dive into this.
Let's jump in. You brought a list of interesting, intriguing startups in the tech. Let's talk about those and the technology that enables it, and why you think those are noteworthy to our audience.
Sure. Well, I'll start off with one that maybe not kind of on everyone's radar. And partially because they're not really an independent company anymore. There's a company called INLT or Inlet, I guess depending on how you want to pronounce it. They sort of emerged in 2018 and were actually acquired by Amazon, again, very under the radar, in 2019. I think it was around late summer 2019.
Wow.
What Inlet did and still does within Amazon is they are sort of a digital customs brokerage. So really niche, very specialized, especially on U.S. imports. They're not even like a global customs broker, right? So why is that interesting? Well, they sort of came up in the wake of, you know, digital fill in the blank, you know, models that had come up, you know, throughout the last decade, whether it be digital forward or digital broker. So I found it interesting that there were more of these niches that were being filled by kind of digital variants to the incumbents that were out there. And there's obviously thousands of customs brokers out there. But then when they got bought by Amazon, I found, okay, well, I'm not the only one who thinks they have kind of an interesting view of things or an interesting model, right? Obviously, there's people with a lot more skin in the game that think what they're doing is pretty
interesting. Just understand. So you thought they were a big deal, or you thought they were interesting before they got acquired?
Before. I see. Before, yeah. In fact, I had their one of their co-founders speaking at our LogTech event in October of 2018. At our very first LogTech conference at JOC, I had someone from them, and not even sure I had covered them at all, but they were always on my radar. And then all of a sudden I got a message that summer saying, hey, by the way, we can't say anything public about this, but this is what is going to be happening. So it was really interesting. And I think what's interesting about it is, that the sort of proliferation of models of traditional structures in the logistics industry that are now kind of being rebuilt or recast on modern tech stacks, basically, you know? And again, they weren't the first one to think about it, but they were sort of one of the originators of that, of applying that to the customs brokerage space, which is, you know, it's a niche, but it's a pretty decent margin niche for companies that do it well. And so is this going to kind of change that whole industry? And is Amazon using it going to kind of help change that industry that much further, or accelerate the change of that industry?
Yeah.
So That's why that one has always been an interesting one for me to kind of think back to.
Yeah, that's an interesting story that Amazon would buy a startup that's just over a year old, right? That's sort of a very uncommon move. I mean, they don't do that many acquisitions. They develop a lot of stuff in-house, or they had a few high-profile acquisitions like the Kiva systems, like the robots, right?
Right.
But not so much this right. little small, how many people were there? 10, 15, 20 people at that time?
It probably wasn't even that many. Yeah. I don't know the exact number, but I would be surprised if it was much over 10.
Yeah, Honestly, and where do you find that point, where do you find that technology inside of Amazon now? How do they use it? Is it part of the Amazon fulfillment network? How do they employ it?
It's part of this. As I understand it, there's Amazon Global Logistics, and then there's another entity within Amazon that I'm spacing on the name on. I should have come prepared to talk about this, okay. But it's something like Amazon Last Mile or Final Mile. It's sort of this basket of services that it seems like they're building around, kind of cross-border sellers that are on their platform and giving them access to kind of manage some more logistics elements than just kind of pushing it through an FBA warehouse that a customs broker or logistics company would normally manage. So really interesting. I mean, you have to go in. I mean, there's a reason why I wanted to start with an Amazon adjacent or company, because every single thing that I write about and talk about, you have to like sort of at least be thinking in the background about what Amazon is doing on it, because they're just that ubiquitous in our space now. So
and even more so after the pandemic. I mean, they've grown leaps and bounds,
right?
Also here in Germany, I mean they have warehouses going up everywhere, and it's just becoming all ubiquitous, and the delivery service showing up here at the doorsteps and so forth. All over the place.
That's right.
Yeah, it's a good one. Interesting find. What next? What's the next one you'll want to present?
The next one is a company called Byco, which is still a relatively small startup. I don't think they've taken much venture funding, if any at all, at this point. They're based in Marseille, France. Mm-hmm. So not your traditional, not exactly Silicon Valley. When people think about...
Do you see a connection there between them not having much venture funding and them being based in Marseille and not in the Valley? Probably.
Well, I think so. I mean, yeah. And actually, that's one of the reasons why I wanted to highlight mm-hmm. Byco is... So they're basically a TMS provider. So you could say that, you obviously had a background at GT Nexus and now InfoNexus. You could say that they are somewhat of a modern competitor for GT Nexus or InfoNexus. They're designed to be purely browser-based, really easy to implement, relatively, low cost to implement. And yet they're targeting big shippers. They're not going after kind of like Instagram, direct to consumer sellers. They're going after big, kind of food and energy shippers. And
right.
And so that, they have big targets. What's interesting to me is, they're kind of, again, tackling a space that is not, they're not landing on the moon and planting a flag on an empty, an empty kind of landscape. There are other vendors out there with a lot of brand equity, a lot of reputational equity, a lot of history. Mm-hmm. But they've come in with this approach that, like, we can do things in a more modern way mm-hmm. than even incumbents that came up 20 years ago can. Mm-hmm. And then the other interesting thing for me is, they are a symbol to me of the proliferation of logistics technology around the world.
Sure.
If you think, to bring up, back to your history at GT Nexus, GT Nexus came up in the Bay Area, right? Yeah. We traditionally think of technology innovation being, kind of confined to certain areas,
sure.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And especially in North America. And here's a company that came up in the shadow of CMA-CGM. Mm-hmm. Their office is not far away from CMA-CGM's yeah. huge headquarters in Marseille. And they have obviously connections there, some of the early employees. But it's a sign to me that you have this proliferation of technology around the world. It's happening in Asia, South America. I talked to founders literally in every continent, because logistics tech is not bound by where the capital exactly is anymore. Mm-hmm. And you know, these guys are founders who had experience in the logistics industry and had to and have to sell their capability and their expertise to a market mm-hmm. that wants to see that. They're not selling it to investors who want, who think that, you know, something can scale 100 times in 2 years.
Yeah, yeah. And I was joking saying earlier that they that there's a connection between them not having venture funding and being in Marseille. I think there is a lot of change happening in Europe in general, especially in Germany. We've seen mm-hmm. a gigantic influx of venture capital into the LogTech space. You probably followed yeah. companies like Sender, for example. They now have a unicorn now.
Yeah.
I mean, incredible. I had the one of the founders, David Notaka, in the BVL Digital podcast a couple of times. Super interesting guy. Super interesting.
I've talked to him. He's one of those guys who you feel smarter after you've talked to him for 30 minutes.
Yeah, and also just very, very likable, very humble, no sense of arrogance, really, really on a mission.
Yeah,
I think we need a big German-based unicorn to jumpstart the entire sort of LogTech ecosystem. It's already on its way, but I think one big exit, for example, and, you know, young founders flush with money, reinvesting it into the system would be great.
I'm really interested in this topic because I think so much of the attention and so much of the capital has been focused on North America. I've been trying my best to, you know, kind of tap into what's going on in Asia, you know, whether it's India mm-hmm. or Singapore mm-hmm. or Hong Kong and Europe especially. I'm definitely noticing the size of rounds going up in Europe. It's still not, I mean, if you take an equivalent company in Europe and North America, you're still likely to get a lot more money
sure.
at an earlier stage yeah. in North America because the European market seems much more pragmatic around that. But it's changing. I think they're starting to see and yeah, I agree. We're now starting to see second generation, even third generation kind of founders emerge yeah. from those early LogTech startups around the world. So yeah, really interesting.
Yeah, this may be a good point in time to ping you on how you actually stay smart and keep track and stay close to these new technologies and this new startups showing up all over the world. I mean, let's say I'm a startup founder, I have a cool LogTech. What's a good way to show up on your radar? I mean, because ultimately, you know, there's an interest of young startups to get some awareness, to get covered by the trade press. I mean, that's still a premium on that.
Sure.
What's a good way for both sides? I mean, for you and for startups to get together in some way and show up on your radar?
That's a good question. I you know, my job is to like know as much of this landscape as possible across virtually every logistics freight mode and every geography. Mm-hmm. Obviously, there's only one of me. I can't, right? My bandwidth is maxes out at a certain point, but I really try to at least meet with everybody that I come across at some point, if not have multiple engagements with them. So, I mean, honestly, the best way is engage with me on social. Mm-hmm. I'm on LinkedIn and Twitter far too much. So that's always a good way to follow mm-hmm. me. At LogTech, Eric is my Twitter handle, and Eric Johnson,
yeah.
you can find me on LinkedIn easily. I post a lot. I have a Substack newsletter that I put out once a week.
That's actually a very good one. I'm a subscriber. I can highly recommend it. Yeah, good stuff.
Yeah, so that's a good way. You know, I do a lot of these podcasts too because I feel like it's a good way to explore my areas of interest with markets that may not be familiar with me as well. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, hopefully our conversation will let people know kind of that I'm interested in their, you know, kind of sweet spot area and reach out.
Yeah.
Email is always a good way too. I'm happy to respond to good old fashioned email as well. So
awesome. Yeah, I mean, that's also not a given or not self understood because I also came across a lot of journalists in my career that wanted to keep a distance, wanted to remain objective and not be seen as taking sides.
Yep.
So it would, you know, there's probably yep. still a fair number of journalists out there who wouldn't come on a podcast and talk about the five startups that they find interesting for fear of sounding biased or sounding sort of yeah, non-objective, right?
That's a good point. And I probably should have prefaced saying this that I have no sort of like skin in the game with any of these companies in terms of whether they ultimately succeed or
no
not.
No secret investor in Bico.
I'm not, definitely not. I'm just, what I wanted to do was kind of think through a list that I find kind of stretches my brain
yeah,
in different ways and put that, yeah, because you're right. It's, There is, a lot, it can be a little insidious, and it can be, I think about it a lot, but I also realize that readers of kind of trade publications or B2B, you know, kind of insights like we hopefully put out at the GOC, they might have an innate feeling that, you know, what we're doing is for a specific reason. Right. And really my only reason for writing what I write is to increase the education and awareness of the industry at large. So, I mean, I write about such a wide variety of companies, sometimes companies that are directly competitive with one another. I literally have no, you know, interest in which ones succeed or not. It's like, it's just my role to help people understand the landscape and, decide for themselves which ones are, you know, have value or not. Right. Yeah. So I'm not into vendor guide selections and that sort of thing. It's really, you need to decide for yourself, and I write to helpfully elevate people's awareness of what's going on.
That's great, and that's what the market needs that too. I think the market needs that sort of a someone that gives advice that comes from long years of experience and a dedication to that space and really understands it at a deeper level, not just artificial level, and it doesn't have a hidden agenda or motive or sort of skin in the game that's not obvious to the outside world.
We do not do pay for play at JOC. It's like we have complete editorial independence.
Well, that's why you're around for 200 years. Otherwise, you would have gone under. That would have been my prediction. Yeah.
That's right. That's exactly right. Yep.
All right. So after that little detour, let's move back to a list. So Byco, anything else to add there, or were you?
No. I think the next area, rather than a single company, is I'm going to sort of talk about a category that I see really sort of making a lot of traction in the space last year and especially into this year, is sort of this process automation or RPA, which is a very kind of like, up until recently, has been a pretty technical term that most people in logistics didn't really have to concern themselves with, but I think is becoming a much bigger factor. Mm-hmm. As opposed to blockchain, as opposed to IoT, which are, you know, things that I think have value in very, you know, specific use cases, but are also major projects. The ROI on them is not necessarily as clearly definable. Process automation, I think it's much easier to sort of, adopt as an organization, and the ROI is pretty clearly defined in most of these cases. So there's a whole bunch of companies that have developed various use cases for RPA. There's one called RPA Labs, mm-hmm. which is, you don't have to go too far on the brand on that. Shipamax, there's a company called Slink that's gotten actually a decent amount of funding. Yep. There's a few others. Vector is another one that comes to mind. Koi Reader is another one that comes to mind. All of them have slightly different approaches, focus on slightly different areas of the business. But the idea is if there's a process that is repeatable, that doesn't vary all that much, should a system be doing that rather than a person? So data entry, responding to basic customer service requests, responding to a request for quote.
Yeah.
Those types of things.
And logistics is ripe with these types of processes, right? Reoccurring, always sort of
absolutely
mechanical, sort of somebody has to open like some file, copy something out of something and paste it into something.
Take data from one system and put it into another system over and over and over.
Yeah, and what all of those vendors that you just described have in common is that they're specialized or are focusing on logistics and supply chain, right? As opposed to the large ones of the industry.
Let's think
about the Celonis and the UiPath as sort of the big daddies.
Right.
They can also do that. I think they also work in supply chain, work in logistics, but there's now a space where these specialized vendors like those come into play that really look at the different processes inside of supply chains. And my guess would be that they hire a lot of people from the space or are originally from that space, so they're intimately familiar with the different processes that can be automated. For example, I had a guy from Slink on the program, and if I remember correctly, he was previously at Kuehne + Nagel and did RPA there. So they brought him over. Now he's at Slink. Yeah, good company. I know a couple of folks over there actually.
Well, and John Urban is an advisor there, right? Yeah. So there's a connection and from his time at GT Nexus. Yeah. So there is a lot of potential there. And you're right. I sort of compare it to the procurement space. Not that they're directly related. I mean, there actually is some automation going on in the procurement space as well, the logistics procurement space. Mm-hmm. But you have, you know, in the last, 15 years, you had a bunch of logistics or supply chain specific procurement software come up trying to compete with general procurement software. And their selling right. point was, no, we have the fields configured and we speak your language from day one, and you're going to have to do some customization with this general purpose. And the same thing with these sort of RPA companies is they walk in and they go, you don't need to explain to us what, the difference between an ocean quote and an LTL quote. We don't need to add any fields for that. We know the business and we can walk in from day one with kind of either a template or, you know, an easy kind of customizable thing for you to implement.
Yeah. So. How do you think about the fact that some of these sort of processes seem like something that's more like a stopgap or a workaround for a process that's not, or like a system that hasn't been invented yet? It looks like something that would work just in the meantime until something better shows up, right? Is that a right sentiment, or am I totally off the track there?
I don't know. I think a lot of people have theorized that, that the kind of supply chains will become more autonomous,
right?
Which kind of negates the need to have, some of these. I think what you're getting at is a lot of the RPA solutions feel like they're automating a process that humans did rather than like rethinking the entire process. Mm-hmm. If I'm understanding your question correctly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I would say yes, but the problem is most companies, I actually just did a story about this that's coming out. It may be out by the time the podcast is out, but a lot of companies, I think, theorize about rewriting their entire supply chain from procurement of raw material to delivery to final customer. But in reality, ripping that all out at one go is like completely unworkable. It's just, it would be suicide to do it, right? So what you end up with is these sort of incremental changes. Mm-hmm. And I just think that's much more realistic. And so maybe 10 years from now, we'll look back and say, yeah, that RPA was in that particular instance was a stopgap rather than changing it forever and ever. But in the meantime, it's still huge progress to go from having a full FTE doing data entry to maybe them doing something more valuable than just looking at one screen and taking a container milestone and putting it into another screen. And, so it's, I think that's really big progress in the short term.
Yeah. And the other thing that often gets overlooked is that whenever a person does something manually, there's no record of it. There's no data being generated. But if you do it with RPA, all of a sudden all this stuff becomes visible, and you can then look at the process and say, oh, wait a second, this takes way too long, or this is way too complicated, or we can skip these steps or whatever, and refashion the entire process from that point.
Yeah, that's a great point. Yeah, the analytics get so much better. So, because it's all structured in the way that you want it structured to look at the end. So, and that's a great point. I think there has been this huge focus in supply chains at large about thinking about the customer and working backwards. So kind of changing it from a supply chain to a demand chain. Mm-hmm. From a technology perspective, I think companies need to think about the same thing. They need to think, what do they want the end to look like, basically, mm-hmm. and work backward from there instead of just saying, well, here's how it works. Let's change X, Y, Z. And hope it turns out different.
Yeah.
So I think there's sort of a parallel there.
Yeah. Yeah. So, okay. Process automation. That was another good one. What's next on your list? The next focus area.
So now we'll probably get into some more of the like household names of the last decade. Visibility. Again, overlapping nicely with this feels like it's a GT Nexus, where this is your life
stuck
recap.
In time, but, Groundhog Day.
Yeah. No, but. Well, it is ground. I mean, visibility is one. I joke that I'm going to be writing about visibility, 50 years from now, right? As if it's still the thing that's to be solved, right? And it's still, there's still so many puzzle pieces still to be assembled. But, we've just seen a lot of activity. Project 44 just bought Ocean Insights. Mm-hmm. Both Project 44 and Four Kites just got big funding rounds, $100 million each. To kind of keep building out their vision for this. There's other competitors in various geographies that, are not ready to give up the fight. And
no, let's throw Shipio into the mix. Shipio from France, right?
Shipio, absolutely. Shipio on the, I mean, there's Sixfold, which got acquired by Transporeon. There is Wakio, which is another small at this point visibility provider in France. There's lots, right, in each geography.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
So it's, yeah, I mean, I think we can expect to see more consolidation. I think the need for shippers to have that multimodal picture has always been there, but now it feels like we're closer to assembling a little bit more of that, just because the individual companies that address it are more sophisticated, and the technologies to connect, you know, different companies is more sophisticated. It feels like we're getting closer, but it may, you know, the dynamics and the demands may completely change in 5 years, and it may feel like it's always just out of reach.
Yeah. So for the casual observer of the space that is not intimately involved in how visibility was supposed to be solved or was tried to be solved in the past, and now with these new players like Project 44 and 4Kites, what is it that they do fundamentally different that hasn't been done in the past, in layman's terms, if there's such thing?
Well, I don't know if they've done so. Both of their origins started in connecting trucks in North America, mm-hmm. right? That's both where they started and built up kind of growth and momentum for their business and got VC funding to expedite that growth.
And that's where Shippeo started too, in the trucking space.
Exactly. So, you know, I boil this down. I always think of a technology needs to be good at one of three things. And it probably needs to be decent at all three, but it needs to really be good at either connectivity. Mm-hmm. So connectivity to assets, to partners. I mean, GT Nexus again was great at that. It needs to be a source that either provides data or pipes in data mm-hmm. efficiently, or it needs to be amazing at optimization. Right, it needs to be a puzzle solving mm-hmm. system, and I ideally you're good at all three of those things, but you're excellent at least one, or else you probably are not going to, you know, find your way in the market. So I think what these two companies have done really well is the connectivity piece. They started off with that, and I think now they're starting to expand and explore or spread their wings on the other elements, especially the optimization stuff, the predictive stuff. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they have the advantage of coming up in an era where APIs are more prevalent and the industry understands what they are and can kind of maybe wean itself off VDI in certain cases and other file formats. They just sort of have the advantage of coming around 10, 15 years later when the soil had been kind of prepared for them to, you know, plant their crops and grow, right?
Yeah, we had to do all the dirty work since 2009 to get...
That's right.
Even before that.
I mean, from the dot-com boom, right? Yeah. Like a lot of the groundwork for what's going on now was laid at the start of the internet era, right? I mean, all of these companies that have come up, they're basically based on the network effects of that are possible through the internet. I mean, if we're going to boil it down to the bare essence of this, like the internet is still the driver of all of these great softwares, as much as AI and machine learning.
Yeah.
And
cloud, to say another way. The reason I said 2009 is because that's when we started using the term cloud, and it was sort of controversial whether we want to use that or not, because it came with so much baggage.
Yeah.
I think we're past that now.
Yeah. Now it's if you're not cloud based, you're sort of seen as being, you know, a bigger risk.
I hope so.
Yeah. So
that's a good one. All right, next one up is more of a theme or a topic of yours, right? Not so much a technology that you want to push, but the whole topic around digital freight forwarders as one of your recurring themes.
Yeah, it's hard to have a conversation about the last 10 years without mentioning Flexport. I only say that because, I mean, they don't necessarily need any more prominence in the industry. They get written about a lot. They do a lot of their own promotion. Their CEO does a ton of podcasts, so... I won't go into like who they are, what they are, but it's undoubtedly that they are a reference point for the rest of the industry. Mm-hmm. So that means they are used sometimes in the same basket of companies as Amazon as, well, we need to build XYZ because Flexport is doing this, mm-hmm. or mm-hmm. Flexport is saying that they are this. And so we need to explain that we also do this. From a fundraising perspective, I can't imagine there's many conversations with VCs that don't start or at some point come to, well, how are you guys different to Flexport, or do you compete with Flexport, right? That that conversation happens a lot, unless it's a logistics or supply chain specific VC at this point. So they are undoubtedly a reference point for the industry at this point, for better or for worse. But what's interesting to me is I think the thesis around Flexport was they were going to kind of fundamentally change the way intermediaries operated and the way the industry looked at intermediaries. And the thought was, okay, well, they're going to get so big, that they're going to, or they're going to force kind of the big operators to change so much that we're going to have a big consolidation effect, and we're going to see power kind of concentrate into the hands of fewer, maybe similar to like the ocean carrier industry. What's actually happened is the opposite. You've seen a sort of reverberation of funding go into technologies that help empower Flexport's competitors and Kuna Nagel's competitors.
Yeah, that's a good
I would say you have more competition now and not less, because A, you have a bunch of technologies that can get in the hands of a small to mid-sized forwarder that doesn't necessarily have a huge budget, but can put together a pretty decent website and dashboards and analytics that they weren't thinking about 5 to 10 years ago. You have a whole crop of new digital forwarders that sort of copied some aspect of the Flexport model, or just did it, you know, in different geographies. You have forwarding alliances in every region that are based not around, you know, having a Rolodex of agents that you can connect with in different regions, but they're actually based around kind of having a franchise set of technologies or a marketplace that their members can access. So it's had the total opposite effect of that. I think the original thesis probably that went into their funding, you know, theorized. Doesn't mean that they won't ultimately be an Uber unicorn. I don't mean Uber the taxi company, but just like a big, the German Uber, not the taxi Uber. I mean, they could still fulfill the promise as their investors see it while this other stuff happens. But I think it just has highlighted how fragmented the industry is. And now we haven't solved the fragmentation problem, even if it is a problem. We've just moved to a different form of fragmentation.
And you were earlier saying that they upped the ante on a couple of major things that advanced the industry and sort of woke people up. What are some concrete examples of where they really sort of upped the ante, so to speak? A couple of examples of capabilities that they brought to the industry?
Yeah, I would say the first and foremost is this seems sort of superficial in a certain way, but the fact that they sort of took a user interface first approach to everything they did was quite revolutionary, because you obviously have dealt with forwarders, at various points in your career. They tended to concentrate their investment internally, you know, operationally, right? That's sure. Their tech investment was not, we're not going to have a fancy website where everything is going to be self-service. We're going to be as good as we can, behind the scenes and present the service to our customers in an offline manner, right? Yeah. They changed that picture in a relatively short period of time. And now there's an expectation that, you have to serve customers however they want to be served. And that also includes having digital capability, whether it's a map that you need to have that's really cool, whether it's predictive ETAs, whether it's analytics dashboards that they're configurable based on what you care about as a shipper. Not all shippers need that or want that right now, but you have to have that capability, or you're going to miss out on a group of customers that are going to say, well, Flexport is giving me that.
Yeah. Yeah. And even just to refer back to the GT Nexus times one more time, actually back in the days, a lot of focus and investment went into the back end as opposed to the front end. That took a long time until we realized that the front end, the way the actual end user interacts with the system is also very, very important.
That's super important.
And that came late in the evolution, I have to admit.
That was part of a broader trend that, you know, our consumer habits started to bleed into our, kind of business lives. Like, we expected the system that we interact with on a daily basis to be as easy to use as an iPhone. And so you can't attribute it to Flexport alone. They sort of rode that wave and realized early on that there was an opening. I think what you've seen now is the last couple of years, they've been much more focused on that operational back end.
Yeah, okay.
To make that front end much more powerful. And so that's going to be, but that's a lot. What I was talking about, that backlash kind of in terms of investment is really been, there's a lot of companies that are focused on that back end now. So that's an interesting point
because I won't name names of companies now, but there used to be companies that had, you know, would show up at trade shows with like gigantic displays and screens of the most beautiful maps and everything.
I think I know who you're talking about. I know what you mean though. Yeah.
But that was the opposite phenomenon where this was so impressive on the outside where people were like, oh my God, this is all possible. But then you look behind the curtain and let's just say it wasn't as, you know, it wasn't as elaborate and as sophisticated as what you see on the front end. What's going on in the back end? You know, let's just leave it at that. But I know we're, you're nodding, so I know what phenomenon we're talking about.
Yep.
Without getting too political.
No, that's fine. What's done is done. We look forward now. There's so much interesting stuff going on. It's important to look forward, right?
Yeah, so. But I really appreciate someone having like a buddy to jam and to sort of riff on these things without thinking about consequences. We can talk about whatever we want to. It's fair. It's a fair assessment. It's our opinions. You know, people can take it or leave it for what it's worth. So
right,
yeah, this is awesome. I really appreciate it. Maybe we'll come back and do more of these next time around in a couple of months or whenever you come back and present some more. Happy to accommodate.
Would love to.
Yeah, I want to see how the audience appreciates a sort of straight talk around these things. I really had fun. This was good stuff. Eric, thanks for taking your time. This was fantastic. I really enjoyed it. We have to do this again one time.
Yeah. I appreciate it, Boris. Really, it was great to chat with you and look forward to coming back someday if I'm lucky enough to be invited back. So
absolutely, absolutely. I can already extend that invitation now. So yeah, just a matter of time.
Cool.
Thanks, buddy. Take care. Until next time.
Thanks, Boris.
All right, that was the Logistics Tribe podcast episode with Eric Johnson of the Journal of Commerce. I hope you had as much fun as I did. And by the way, I do apologize for some of the background noise that was going on there in a few places. And I assure you, that wasn't Eric banging his head against the wall there. I think there was just some maintenance going on in this building. But I hope you didn't find that too distracting. In any case, if you want Eric to come back onto the show for more of these conversations with me about LogTech, let us know and we'll make it happen. You'll find both of us on LinkedIn. Just ping us there. And don't forget to follow or subscribe to the Logistics Tribe podcast so you don't miss any of the future episodes. I'm Boris Felgendreher. Until next time.